The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of Salem Media of Hawaii.
Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. Coming up today, Jeff meets with newsmakers, shares breaking news, spotlights top community activities and leaders. He'll keep you ahead of the news and informed as you make your way home today. So join Jeff Davis right here, right now, and every day at 5. So stay tuned and you'll have something to talk about over dinner tonight with Hawaii's Tomorrow today. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow today.
Aloha! It's me, Brayden DeVos. And again, I ask a favor. Will you help restock the fish on our reefs so when my friends and I go snorkeling, we can see Hawaii as it should be? Mahalo. Thank you, Swiller Guy.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your Marine Science Gal on this Wednesday, February 24th. And I'm pleased to share a special edition of the show focusing on the 2014 Ocean Sciences Meeting. The 17th biannual Ocean Science Meeting began last night and is welcoming some of the top oceanographers and marine scientists from all over the world. It is being held at the Hawaii Convention Center this week till February 28th and is the largest assembly of ocean scientists, engineers, students, educators, and policymakers. And believe me, it is busy. There are a ton of people there. So let's get to it without further ado. Our first guest today is Dr. Tracy Wigner, who sits on the Scientific Committee for Ocean Sciences. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Aloha.
Aloha. So not only are you sitting on the scientific committee, you are based at the University of Hawaii, Hilo. You are associate professor of marine science. What do you study when you're not planning conferences?
My expertise is in coastal water quality. So I look at what comes off the land and to the ocean, looking at how it changes the water quality and how the organisms in the water respond to those changes. We have a water quality buoy that gives real-time information to people who are using the water as well.
Excellent. And are you going to share some of that research at the Ocean Sciences Meeting?
Dr. Jason Adolph will be sharing some of our buoy data.
Okay, excellent. And how did you get involved with planning the meeting?
Actually, Dr. Debbie Bronk, who is at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, knew me from earlier, and she was the president of ASLO at the time. And she wanted to promote a young woman into the planning organization, and she knew that I was in Hawaii, so one day I got a phone call.
We love young women in science. That's excellent. And for our listeners, what is ASLO?
It used to stand for the American Society of Limnology and Oceanography, and now I believe it is the Association for Limnology and Oceanography.
I did not realize there was a name change there. All right.
I could be wrong.
And so this meeting happens, it travels around all over. Why Hawaii?
The ocean science has come to Hawaii a couple of times. Since I've been in Hawaii, it's been here at least two times prior. They were very excited to have it here in Hawaii because Hawaii is so closely connected with the ocean and the strong cultural tie. They thought it was a perfect place to have it.
It's really neat, too, you know, being at the convention center right now and you're walking around and you're hearing all these different languages being spoken, and it truly is an international conference, and it's so wonderful to showcase some of the really cool things in Hawaii to this international audience. How are they incorporating some of the local culture into the conference and sharing that with these people?
Well, I think in part because I was able to be on the committee, I was able to incorporate our students from the University of Hawaii at Hilo into the opening program. The speaker that was chosen was Dr. Elizabeth Lindsay from the National Geographic Society, and she spoke about using knowledge from the elders to help us better understand the 21st challenges that we face. And the students opened up the ceremony doing chants very specific to the beginning of a meeting, the place where we're holding the meeting, and to open everybody's mind to absorb the information coming in, and then also to honor our speaker, who is a wayfinder.
And she got a standing ovation, might I add.
She was amazing.
Yeah, she was fantastic. So there's also a focus on early career and student mentoring at this conference, more so than I've seen in a lot of other conferences, which is absolutely fantastic to see. Can you tell me about some of these programs?
So one of the programs is they hook students and early career people up with more senior scientists. This morning we had a mentor-mentee breakfast where we got to meet each other and talk about science and careers and opportunities. Tomorrow there'll be another breakfast for the Oceanography Society as well. There are also, there's the multicultural program, and lots of student posters and people judging them and providing them with input.
It's fantastic. And, I mean, there's stuff for students, there's stuff for early and late career, all kinds of things happening, even things for the public. There are so many highlights, but do you have any special tips or favorites that you're planning on attending?
I am interested to hear the panel on Wednesday where they're going to have Richard Harris from NPR, since I hear him all the time on the radio, and they're going to be discussing why aren't people listening to us with regards to climate change and all the challenges that we're going to be facing in the near future.
Well, we've definitely talked a lot about that on this show, so hopefully people are listening. And is there anything else that you're really looking forward to or that you're hoping to take away from the conference?
I think the biggest thing for me was to see our students on the stage last night, opening the ceremony, the passion that they brought to it to be able to share their culture with the scientists attending this meeting was the best thing for me.
And the positive reception that people gave towards that was just, it was very emotional. It was breathtaking.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. I can't wait to participate in this week's events. And one of these highlights for me not only incorporates marine sciences, but the connection to Hawaii. And this is the Hawaiian Island Science Town Hall meeting, which is happening Thursday evening and is open to the public. With us now is Eric Tong, the co-founder of Hawaiian Islands Science, as well as a graduate student in the Department of Oceanography at the University of Hawaii Manoa, as well as Kaipo Perez, who is the Ocean and Recreation Specialist with the City and County of Honolulu, and also a recent PhD graduate from University of Hawaii. So welcome to the show, you two.
Mahalo. Aloha mai.
Aloha. So, Eric, Hawaiian Island Science, or HISAI, let's just call it HISAI now.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are hosting this event on Thursday, but first tell us, what is HISAI?
Well, if I had to say HISAI, it's kind of a grassroots Native Hawaiian graduate student initiative, and what we seek to do is to amplify the voice of our kupuna in the sciences and to promote various ways of knowing and also a rooted ethic in the practice of scientific research, both at the university level and also within the community as well.
This is a unique group. I mean, we don't see this too often. How did you guys get together to start this?
Well, it started out as a few friends supporting each other through graduate school. It's kind of a long and arduous path. So we were discussing our ideas over beers regularly, starting to create a small space at Manoa for this conversation that kind of expanded what we were being taught as science to encompass more of an aina-based vision within the sciences as more of a, you know, on the research side of things. The gatherings kind of grew, and we pulled in our friends, and we pulled in more acquaintances and classmates and people from on and off campus, and things just sort of grew out from there.
Now, I know you guys collectively meet, and you do these science cafes, but you do some other things as well. You host other events. What kind of things do you do besides science cafes?
Okay, so those gatherings are where it all started, that kind of has transitioned and been restructured into kind of a networking platform for us. And we call that the HISAI Pub because it's informal. We come together, you know, we've all discuss our ideas. It's a community that we're trying to build of Kanaka Maoli students, local students, to share their ideas, opportunities, collaborations across the disciplines on campus, pulling in social sciences, pulling in Hawaiian studies, just trying to bring that back. And sometimes it's at the bar, and sometimes we serve Ava and have sessions where we kind of get deeper into some of the issues. And the cafe is pretty much the public side of things, where we come out into the community and try to address the bigger issues that are at the intersection of science and community.
I think that's an important point. You guys aren't just dabbling in lighthearted issues. So you guys are tackling some really good topics. Can you give us some example of topics that you've covered in the past?
Yeah, so a lot of these issues that have an element of controversy here today in Hawaii do have an element of science to them. You know, we have no shortage of issues remaining to tackle, but in the past, as appropriate, when the time came up, we kind of wanted to bring information to the forefront. For example, for wind energy, when there were communities struggling on Lanai to kind of preserve their way of life, that discussion needed to be had about an understanding of climate change, how it influence our rainfall, as well as our students on the west side and trying to work in partnership with Leeward Community College to open up pathways for students to get into engineering and science on the ground level, and, you know, bringing it from kind of, you know, agriculture and, you know, boating and things that kind of relate to our cultural identity and our way of life and things that will propel us towards a sustainable future into research avenues.
Excellent. And Kaipo, you were asked to help with the planning for this forum at Ocean Sciences, and the forum is on traditional marine resource management. Can you tell us a little bit about what you guys have up your sleeve?
Well, it's an open forum, and it consists of a panel that has cultural practitioners, scientists, legal advisors, and some of these people who are sitting on this panel wear multiple hats. And it's going to be in a kuka-kuka, or a discussion format, and we're going to be discussing things like traditional marine resource management, efforts in collaborative resource fisheries with ecosystem-based management, community-based subsistence fisheries areas, MPAs, local ER, fishing ponds, and basically we're looking to get a cultural perspective as well as a Western perspective, so bridging the two gaps between the two in order to provide a more holistic approach for marine resource management in hopes that the future of Hawaii and other places can learn from each other in order to make sound decisions concerning these resources.
And you guys have an all-star cast planned for this session. I mean, you're flying in people from other islands, so there's going to be guaranteed to be a diverse perspective there, lots of different communities. You said you're doing sort of a discussion panel, but it's more incorporating everyone who's there, and that's kind of a different approach. Why do that? Why not just have people present and talk to those that are listening?
I think it's to provide the voice for all individuals there so that everybody has an equal opportunity to share their mana'o. And we can basically ea'okaua, or learn together, learn from each other, because each person brings their own mana'o to the table wherever they come from. So that gives us an opportunity to incorporate everybody while focusing on our individuals who are immensely knowledgeable of their particular fields and other disciplines as well.
And so both of you, it's a pretty diverse panel. People are going to have different opinions, and it could get a little heated. How do you deal with that?
Oh, let's say we've gotten pretty good at some parts of facilitation, not so great at other parts. I mean, these are charged subjects that we tend to breach. So we just base our trust on our audience and our panelists to lead us through. You know, waves hit the canoe and you just kind of reorient and take the conversation where it needs to go. But hopefully this Thursday we'll have a very safe space for people to come and join us and discuss this very important subject.
I'm sure it will be. Yeah. And is this event open to the public?
Free and open to the public. Ehele mai.
Okay, so for those of our listeners that are interested, we've baited them enough. Where did they go? What did they do? Where can they get information?
Okay. Information can be found on a Facebook event page. So come like us at Hawaiian Island Science in your Facebook. We also have a blog. It's hiscience.wordpress.com. The event is this Thursday, 6:30 p.m., February 27th, at the Hawaii Convention Center, room 313A. That's the O'ahu room.
Excellent. And that's the escalator app. And we're also posting it on the COSI website, cosi-ie.net. We are a proud partner. Have to plug that in, of course. Well, thank you so much to all three of you for getting us started here and talking about some of the really neat events at Ocean Sciences. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors today, Leakmaster Roofing, Grand Solar, BenQ Solar, University of Hawaii Research Corporation. We'll take a quick traffic break.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Going west is normal. The H1 slows on the airport viaduct. The Moana Lua slows at the Fort Shafter overpass. The heavy stuff is going to continue to the Waimalu Pearl City exit. If you're heading north on the H2, watch for a stall at the Mililani Malka exit. The Windward Drive, normal, but traffic coming over from the Windward side is slower on the Likelike. That's because of that stall inside the Wilson Tunnel. No problems to Hawaii Kai.
Aloha, it is your solar guy, Jeff Davis, with Kamiyama Solar. And we're a 25-year licensed contractor. We do all our own work, and it's the end of the year. If you have questions, if you have solar needs, we're a small company. We still have some open availabilities, whether it's solar electric, solar hot water, solar pool pumps, solar attic fans, any solar products. You can call me right now at 554-7200, 554-7200. Get it in before the end of this tax year. And aloha to you.
Aloha. Hawaii's Tomorrow and Jeff Davis are looking for motivated people. Are you a writer? The Solar Guy could use some comedy. Would you like to intern? You know he's got room, so give Jeff a call. Jeff Davis at 554-7200. 554-7200.
Aloha nohoi kako and ho mai kai nohoi praise to Jeff Davis.
You're terrible.
I'm terrible.
I love you, Ruby. Aloha. Aloha. This is your solar guy, Jeff Davis, here. If you have any questions regarding HECO's new regulations for photovoltaics or solar electric in your neighborhood, as you know, they have new rules. Just call me at 554-7200. I'll answer your questions most likely right over the phone, 554-7200. And please don't forget, solar hot water, solar-powered pool pumps, solar heating, all that is good to go. I can handle any of those questions as well. Call your solar guy at 554-7200. Aloha. Aloha. This is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. Do you want free 5 panels? How about a free trip to Vegas? I know, free financing. Then don't call me. For 25 years, Kamiyama Solar believes in treating our clients with respect. We do not subcontract. We do not offer anything for free besides aloha. What we do offer is hands-on installation with 25 years of experience and a 10-year workmanship warranty. Call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200. Aloha at 554-7200.
Hi, I'm Frank Rogers from Leakmaster Roofing and the Cool Roof Store. We sell and install protective roof coatings for all types of roofs. What kind of roof do you have? For flat roofs, we recommend silicone roof coatings because they withstand unlimited ponding water and they come with a 50-year material warranty. We feature trusted names like Geico, NXT Cool Zone, and Apoc Silicone with some of the lowest prices in town. If you have a Monier roof or a metal roof, we recommend that you recoat them with NXT Cool Zone to make them shine like new. Asphalt shingles can be protected and waterproof for the lifetime of your home with the Cool Roof Store's ceramic coating. Whether you want Leakmaster Roofing to install the coating or want to do it yourself, come on down to our store in Kaka'ako or visit us at leakmaster.com. Why re-roof when you can simply recoat?
My name is Braden DeVos, and I believe in education. I say get one. Take it, Solar Guy.
Aloha. Welcome back to the show. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. And today we are focusing on the important 2014 Ocean Sciences meeting that is happening this week in Honolulu. The meeting not only encompasses important marine scientists, but those who educate about marine science. One of the unique ways to do this is through film. And this year, two COSE centers, that's Centers for Ocean Science Education Excellence, have been offering film competitions, COSE Island Earth and COSE Florida. Here to talk about these video competitions is the Ocean 180 Video Challenge team. So they are coming from COSE Florida. Joining us all the way from Florida today is Mallory Watson and Dr. Richard Tinkersley, Professor of Biological Sciences at the Florida Institute of Technology. And Mallory is a scientist with COSE Florida. Welcome to the show.
Aloha. It's great to be here.
Aloha. Thank you so much for joining us. Are you guys jet lagged?
A little bit.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure the jet lag will quickly fade away with the excitement that you guys are about to generate. Tell me, what was the inspiration for this Ocean 180 video challenge?
Well, COSI Florida and all the COSI centers have been interested in working with scientists to help them share their science with folks outside of their discipline, the general audiences. And so we thought it was a great opportunity for scientists to challenge scientists to think of ways in which they can translate the research they do into a short 3-minute video that would provide the sort of excitement or experience that they have as scientists in a way that would reach those audiences.
And were you personally inspired to do a video, or?
Well, I was not allowed to, because we were running the competition, right. But we wanted to take advantage of the fact that scientists are interested in being able to communicate their science more effectively, but also the interest in using video as a medium for doing that. Scientists, unfortunately, spend a lot of time and get a lot of training in how to do science, but very little training in how to share their science. And so we saw it as an opportunity to challenge them to think of creative ways that they could engage these audiences.
And I think that's so important. Just in the first day of the conference, I've been hearing a lot through the Ocean Sessions, is it's all about a narrative, telling your story, your science story, through a storytelling format. And that's exactly what you guys have been encouraging. So that's fantastic. And it's not your typical film competition either. So you had other components to this. What else did that entail?
Well, it was a two-phase process. So we encouraged scientists or challenged those scientists to come up with a video. And these videos had to be based upon published research. And so it really was difficult for scientists to think about ways in which they could take this research and translate into something that would reach these audiences. And then we had the videos that we received evaluated by a group of science experts and communication experts who narrowed the field down to the top 10 videos. And then we had students, eighth grade students or middle school students, evaluate the videos and determine whether or not they felt that it was a compelling story that the scientists had come up with.
And that's so empowering, too, because usually, it's the adults judging the kids or younger audience in this format. So we've really reversed it, and it's the students who are probably a little bit more with it, with the media and stuff, judging what the videos are.
They're extremely critical. We got some great feedback from the students. What was interesting is that much of what they criticized scientists in terms of and the types of things that they looked for in the videos were similar to what we saw from the communication experts. So it was a great group to use to be able to provide this kind of feedback.
It's good to know they're tuned in. And you were able to reach a huge audience with this film competition. How big was the participation, and how did you get so many people to do this?
We ended up with over 30,000 middle school students in 48 U.S. states, the U.S. Virgin Islands, D.C., and 13 countries. So it was a very, very big audience. It was really exciting for us to know that there were that many teachers who wanted their students to see ocean science in maybe a different way. We relied a lot on social media. It was an incredibly powerful tool in engaging these teachers. And a lot of it was word of mouth. A lot of teachers told their colleagues that, hey, this is a great way for you to learn about ocean science and get your kids involved.
And it wasn't just science teachers. I mean, we had teachers who may be teaching different subjects that really saw it as an opportunity to engage their kids in the process of evaluation and how you give feedback to folks and use it as an opportunity to embed science into other subjects.
So you had teachers actually working with their classes on this project. Did you get a lot of feedback from the teachers, that this was something they could relate to their curriculum or something that was a really positive experience for their classroom?
Yeah, we've gotten a lot of great feedback from them so far. I've heard from about 90 teachers out of the 460 that participated, and over half have told me that they've been able to meet education standards with it, or that 75% of their students have been more interested in science, and close to 90% are telling us that they'd want to participate again. So this has definitely been an impactful experience for them. A lot of them have commented this is something they want to see more of. They want to see Earth 180 and other video challenges that bring science forward in a completely different way, aside from what they read in their textbook or what the teacher tells them. It's good to see it happening in real life and know that science is more than just what's in their textbook or on their next test.
Absolutely. And so what were the students judging the videos on? What was the criteria?
They were looking at the creativity. They were looking at if they learned anything, but they were really looking at if there was a story being told, if they could then relate what the scientists explained to somebody else. So how relatable was the message? How clear was the message? And a lot of the videos, students, you know, they liked, they scored high, but they didn't get the relevance. They didn't get the message. And so maybe gave it a few marks off because that was still important to them to be able to feel empowered to understand an incredibly complex scientific process or discovery.
And this is the first time you've done this competition, so kudos on pulling off such a well-executed first try at this. You know, what have you sort of learned about this, and are you planning on doing it again next year?
Well, we're getting ready for next year already. So even though we haven't announced the winners of this year's competition, we're using a lot of the information we're getting back from all the participants, the judges, the students, the scientists who submitted videos, the teachers. We're using that to refine the competition for next year. We're hopeful that we'll get more submissions, that it'll be an opportunity for scientists to think about ways in which they can translate their science to this audience. But we're also planning to, because scientists don't get much training in how to do this, we're planning to develop some workshops to help scientists to be able to use video as a effective medium for communicating.
That's fantastic. What types of mediums are you using for the video workshops?
Well, these will be face-to-face workshops. These will be opportunities for scientists to come together and collaborate with video experts, with storytellers, to think about ways in which they can really improve their communication skills and using video as the medium to do that.
That's excellent, and that is a great skill to have. So I know you're not supposed to, but I have to ask, because from one COSI center to another, you know, if you could give us any exclusive hints, at least some hints about the winners we're going to hear about tomorrow.
Well, I will say that the finalists were selected again by our science judges, but the students were, as I mentioned earlier, very critical of the types of videos and the quality of the videos. But all the ones that are selected amongst the winners are ones that did a very effective job of thinking about the audience that they were delivering these videos to or preparing these videos for, and telling a story that included themselves, that really tapped into making the video relatable to that audience and making themselves a part of the story. And so you'll see that in the winners some common features about that they include those sorts of elements.
Now, that was a very diplomatic answer. what about themes? Can you at least tell us about some of the winning themes?
We have a wide range of science topics covered. Actually, none of the top four videos even are in the same field. So our students definitely selected videos that were a range of topics. And I think it's worth noting that a lot of our students had said they found interest in a subject they didn't even know existed in a lot of these top videos. So kudos to the scientists for inspiring a whole new generation to do something maybe they didn't know was possible.
Well, you guys are very diplomatic and made my job difficult here. So why Ocean Sciences Meeting? Why hold out till now to announce winners?
Well, we thought it was a great opportunity to go back to the community that we were that we've been working with to really showcase the videos, to show other ocean scientists what they can do through video, to encourage them to submit a video next year. So we've been doing a lot of outreach this week, talking to other scientists about how they can prepare videos and join the competition next year, because even though it was our first year, we were very happy with the submissions we got, but we're hoping for a lot more next year.
And so since you won't, really, you're very tight-lipped about this. Where can we find out about the winners, and where can we go to see the winning videos?
Well, we're going to announce the winners tomorrow at 4:00 at the meeting. The announcement will also show up simultaneously on our website at www.ocean180.org, and it'll be an opportunity to all the finalists are there, and we'll post also a video that shows a group of students who are going to reveal who the winners are. So you'll be able to see that video as well.
Well, I'm very excited, and I guess I will have to wait with the rest of the world until the release of the winners are announced. But it sounds fantastic. And, you know, in another video, we recently discussed the Kosi Island Earth Student Ocean Film Competition, which was announced last month at the Waimea Ocean Film Festival. And on our December show, we talked about this. And I have calling in Emily Gonzalez, who is our Kosi Island Earth Communications graduate assistant. And she actually just popped out of class, so I hope I didn't get her into trouble.
Hi,
Hi, Emily. How you doing?
I'm great.
Well, thanks for taking a couple seconds to call in and chat with us today.
For sure. I'm happy to.
Well, you were very instrumental in the Kosi Island Earth Student Film Competition. Can you tell our listeners what that film competition entailed?
Well, we reached out to public schools, public and private schools in the state of Hawaii, and invited students to participate by sending short films that were ocean science related. We did ask that, we kept it pretty broad. The theme was, ocean related, but they could really take it any direction they wanted. If they wanted to, go from an experiential angle or a science angle, we really kind of, left it open to their imagination. As it was the first time we did this, we wanted to leave it pretty broad. But we were really kind of overwhelmed with the support that we got and the entries that we received, smaller number than was received by the Ocean 180 group. It sounds like their contest was phenomenal, but we were really pleased to get the participation that we did this first go round, and we're happy to announce the winner at the festival in January.
And so what were the winners and what were some of their films about?
The first place winner was from Lokalani Intermediate. Aisake Sakava, Megan King, and Ben King submitted a film about Skippy Howe, an aquatic biologist from Maui. The runner-up was a film from Nui Valley Middle School. Chad Ikigami, Landon Marai, and Jonathan Wohler submitted a film entitled The Dirty Ocean. And it was about keeping the ocean clean and sustainability issues. Then there were also some honorable mentions given to La Pietra, Nui Valley Middle School, and to Le Jardin. All of the films were really, really great, and we wish we could have honored all of them at the festival. We were really happy with the efforts and the participation of the kids. It was really great. Really great to get that much participation.
It sounded, you know, we did have a huge success with the films and a lot of support from the teachers here.
Yeah.
Do you plan, are we going to do this again next year? Do you have plans to participate in that?
Yeah, we're hoping to. We got great feedback from the teachers and the schools and the students that participated, and great feedback from the festival, and we're hoping to bring it back at the next festival for sure.
Excellent. Well, thanks for taking some time to chat with us today, Emily. Is there anything
Thank
else
you,
you want
Carly.
To share?
No, that's about it. Just really excited to hear about ocean science and K-12 partnerships. It's really exciting to see.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, and have a great evening.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I want to take a chance here, too, to thank Mallory and Dr. Tankersley from Kosi, Florida, and both to Emily Gonzalez from Kosi Island Earth, who made some time to share these wonderful marine science film stories. And we are waiting with bated breath to find out about the Ocean 180 Challenge. So one more time, where can we go to find that information?
If you are attending the Ocean Sciences meeting at the poster session tomorrow at 4 p.m., we'll be at the COSI booth announcing them and our poster. And you can go online to ocean180.org and see a full list of finalists, and the winners will be posted tomorrow after the announcement.
Fantastic. Well, stick around, because we've got a lot more exciting ocean sciences coming up. Next, we're going to talk with Dr. Richard Feely, who came to Ocean Sciences all the way from Seattle. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors here today: D.R. Horton Schuler Homes, University of Hawaii Federal Union, R&R Solar Supply, and Hank's Taxi Service.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
If you're heading to town from the windward side on the H3, you're going to find some slow traffic. It's because of a stalled truck in the Hirono Tunnel. No problems reported to the windward side. If you're going west from town, the H1 slows at the airport exit on the viaduct. The Moanalua slows at Middle Street. Inbound traffic from the west slow from Ola Lane to the Punahou exit. No problems out to Hawaii Kai.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
Hi, it's Jeff. Aloha. It seems as though Hawaiian Electric has made their decision to slow down photovoltaic solar electric installation throughout this last tax season. Many people have turned to battery storage systems to save money on the upgrades and to beat the tax season. These battery storage systems are standalone. You're not connected to the grid. You do receive this year's tax credits for them, and you can install them in any area on the island at any time. It's a fantastic idea. Now, I'm Kamiyama Solar, and we've installed many of these systems in the past. If you have any questions for me, they can be answered generically with a phone call. So go ahead and get to me, Jeff Davis, your solar guy, regarding battery storage systems for your photovoltaics this year at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. Aloha.
Aloha, it's Jeff. Is it hotter in your home than out on your lanai? Do you wish there was an energy-efficient way to cool down? Wouldn't it be nice to turn on the trays at the flip of a switch? Well, my friends at Island Cooling have been quietly promoting the energy-efficient whole house fan for years. It works by drawing fresh air through your home, pushing the hot air out through your attic. Call the whole house fan experts at Island Cooling, 672-2300, 672-2300, or go to islandcooling.com. Aloha.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis. You know, I'm offering you folks a chance to get an education, this time about on-bill financing. You've heard about the new bill the governor signed, paying for your photovoltaic system on your electricity bill. As you may know, the governor just signed this revolutionary bill, and it is directed and aimed at folks that have no ability to find the upfront money for their photovoltaic purchase. If you have questions, you can always call me or attend my seminar. Get a hold of me at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. And aloha.
So you're doing the right thing. You're getting a solar voltaic system for your home or business. But did you know the crucial decision is which microinverter to choose? A microinverter is what's going to convert the sunshine from your solar panels into electricity you can use.
But not all microinverters are created equal.
The Enexis microinverter system dramatically boosts energy harvest with higher wattage microinverters. We're talking up to 40% over its competitors. Year after year, you'll be getting more bang for your buck.
Because not all microinverters are created equal.
So make sure your contractor offers the Enexis microinverter with the system you can monitor yourself. Your system will shine today and be ready for a brilliant tomorrow. For more information, visit enexis.com. That's enexis.com. E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com. That's E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
Hi, I'm Skylar, and I'm a Wish Kid and the CEO of High Sky. I don't believe in Santa Claus, but I believe in Jeff Davis. Take it away, Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and with us now is Dr. Richard Feely, a NOAA Senior Fellow at the Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory and holds an affiliate faculty position at the University of Washington School of Oceanography. Welcome to the show.
Thank me, I'm on the show. That's wonderful to be here.
Well, thank you. So when did you get into Honolulu?
We got back here on Saturday. And we've been in meetings ever since. There's lots of side meetings to go on besides the Ocean Sciences Conferences that started today.
Well, hopefully you'll get be able to get out a little bit and enjoy the sunshine.
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, thanks for carving some time out of your schedule to come here today, because you had a very important day.
We did. We had the most extensive session on ocean acidification that has ever occurred in an ocean science conference to date. And it goes into tomorrow, too. We've got 2 days of sessions.
It was unbelievable. I was flipping through the program, looking at some of the sessions, and there were so many to choose from. And your session on ocean acidification, I think I counted 24 people just today speaking on this topic. So obviously something of importance.
It's very important. When we burn fossil fuels, coal and oil and natural gas, all that CO2 goes up in the atmosphere. And every single day, mankind releases about 70 million tons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And about a quarter of that ends up in the ocean every day. And over time, that decreases the pH of the oceans and causes the acidity to go up. And since the pre-industrial era, our acidity of our oceans has gone up about 30%. So we're getting very concerned with what that means for our ocean environment and the ecosystems that exist in that environment.
Now, I don't think a lot of people realize that, you know, there is no wall between the atmosphere and the ocean. So what goes into the atmosphere ends up getting absorbed by the ocean. The ocean does a very good job of absorbing some of these nutrients gases. Why should we be concerned about carbon going into our oceans or ocean acidification?
Well, actually, about 10, 15 years ago, we always thought that was a good thing because as that oceans take up the carbon dioxide, that removes it from the atmosphere and causes a cooling of the Earth. And the oceans will end up taking up about 85 or 90% of the carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere. But we, in the last 15 years or so, we've seen that many organisms that exist in the oceans can't handle all the CO2 that's going in. And in fact, it has a serious impact on their survival. Many organisms that produce a calcium carbonate shell or skeleton, the ability to produce that shell or skeleton is directly dependent on the concentration of CO2 in the water. And they slow down that ability to produce that shell or skeleton, or sometimes the shell will begin to dissolve. Along our coast of Washington, Oregon, we have already seen that impact on organisms living on our coast. And it's already affecting the shellfish industry in a major way.
So for those of us who didn't get to attend the session, animals that create calcium carbonate shells, what are we talking here? Corals? Or can you give us some examples?
Sure. Corals are a major contributor of shells and skeletons that produce a whole ecosystem. And because of the large structures of the corals, many of our beautiful species of fish and animals live there. In fact, 25% of the fish that live in the ocean spend some time in a coral reef ecosystem. So as the acidification impacts the ability of the corals to produce that skeleton, it will affect that entire ecosystem. And coral reefs are some of the most diverse ecosystems on the planet. So we really want to protect them. So we got to be concerned about how much CO2 that goes into the atmosphere and how it will affect these ocean ecosystems over the next 10, 20, 30 years.
Well, this is of global concern for sure, but especially here in Hawaii where we are so dependent and so close to our coral reef systems. You do a lot of work globally, but you've also done some work in Hawaii. Is that correct?
That's right. I work with scientists from here at the University of Hawaii, and we put an array of moorings around Hawaii to see what the effect of acidification. Dr. Eric DiCarlo from the University of Hawaii is the lead scientist in this. We have our instruments that are going out on his moorings every day, and so we can see the changes in the oceans in real time, and we can see the impacts they have on our coral reef ecosystems right now. And some of the scientists from the University of Hawaii are the leading experts on the impacts of acidification on coral reef systems. And it's really amazing the different studies that have occurred and what the impacts are. These are the youngest scientists, the newest graduate students, performing some of their very first experiments and coming up with the most exciting results we've seen thus far. And they were presenting it today. It was a very exciting day today.
Yeah, can you give us some highlights? What were some of the things people were talking about?
Well, there was some very exciting results. The first time I've seen very interesting results with crabs. Turns out that the very early life stages of crabs are very, very sensitive to acidification, and they have to go through 4 or 5 life stages, and the impact of the CO2 on each of the life stages is different. So we have to study those impacts on each of those life stages. And it turns out the very earliest stages, when they just hatch, many of the crab species have only so much energy to get through from one life stage to the next. And when you have a stressor like CO2, the survival rate goes way down. So you can imagine if we continue to increase CO2 levels such that they can't get through those four or five life stages, what's going to happen to the entire population? Crab is really important to our fishery. In the United States alone, crab fisheries, hundreds of millions of dollars. This is really important for our economy and our food security to get an understanding of how acidification affects each species and how that species affects the entire ecosystem. The tiny crabs are food for fish, and so therefore the fish would be infected, and we as humans who like to eat crabs and fish, we're concerned about that.
And that's really interesting because it's the first time I've heard anyone, you know, bring in some of the human dimensions and some of the economics that could be affected from ocean acidification. It's a fascinating story. What else were you hearing today in some of the presentations?
Well, I was really excited. There were some very interesting studies about some of the clam species. Gretchen Hoffman talked about the bivalve species that they study on the west coast of the United States. And she was showing how when you look through one generation to the next, you can see that they can build up an adaptation capacity. They can resist by the changes in the genomics, the changes in the gene structure, and how the organisms respond to the stress and how they can live through the stress. Now, that's unique for some organisms that have enough energy reserves to actually adapt to those changes. But it turns out that other species, for example, some oyster species, they never get through that first stage, and they actually die off. That's what we're seeing happening in the oyster hatcheries on the West Coast. When the waters get acidic enough on the West Coast, and we have a natural enhancement of the acidification on the West Coast, those oyster larvae die within 2 days. And this was a point where the entire shellfish industry was at stake. $110 million industry was at stake. And if we didn't provide an adaptation strategy that would work, to allow the scientists to work together from developing tools that they put right in the hatchery itself, knowing exactly how much acidity those were, changing the chemistry of the water coming into the tanks, we were able to save that industry within 1 year's time. So with the government coming in, providing the support of the scientists to put the instruments right in the hatchery, we were able to change that entire industry so that in 1 year's time, we save that industry $35 million and develop an adaptation strategy that work for the future.
That's amazing, and it's nice to see some really bright spots or applied knowledge from this. That's fantastic. And what about your own research? Do you have plans to continue or start some new research relating to ocean acidification?
Yes, within my group. I work at the NOAA Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, and our laboratory does the monitoring for the West Coast, including Hawaii. So we put out the sensors to see how the chemical changes are taking place. And we work with the National Marine Fisheries Service here again in Hawaii that goes out and surveys all the island areas. And we also work with the National Marine Fisheries Service in the Washington and Oregon and Alaska states. And we look at each individual commercially important species as well as the ecosystem itself, from the phytoplankton to the zooplankton that the fish eat, all the way up to the pollock and the salmon, and see how these changes, these ecosystems, affects every step along the way. So the organisms the fish need to eat for food, we're studying those changes of those organisms and how that will relate through the food chain. Then we're also modeling this for the first time, how the chemical changes are taking place and how the ecosystem will change so that we can predict what will happen 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, and begin to develop a strategy for adapting to these changes and perhaps find strategies where you can mix two different groups of organisms together so they can adapt together to withstand these changes. So this is very exciting.
It is exciting stuff. And, you know, for those of us that don't get out on research trips or are familiar with some of these methods, you know, you say you put these sensors out and then make these models. You know, that's a lot. That's very abstract for some of us. What can you walk us through what these sensors look like and how you get from information in a sensor to a model?
Sure. We put out these buoys that sit at the surface of the ocean, and they go all the way down with the line all the way down to the bottom. And we have sensors all the way down. And they determine the chemistry and the physical parameters in the water column. They just determine the pH of the water very, very accurately. We determine the CO2 concentration. We have the physics of the winds and the circulation. All this telemetered back to our laboratory. So I can sit at my desk and I can look at our mooring that's sitting off of Coconut Island.
It's amazing.
And we look at the other mooring that's sitting off of Waikiki Base. And I can see what's going on every single day. And then we feed that into the models, and the models will then project what the changes will take place through a course of a season or from 1 to 2 to 10 years. And then we can see how well, because of the observations, how well the models are working. And then if you put that into a food web model, you can project to see what that means, how the ecosystem will change in future.
That's excellent. I mean, this is such an important topic, and I'm so happy you had some time to talk with us. You're running a session again tomorrow, you mentioned?
Yes. We have a session tomorrow. We just finished a poster session this afternoon. We have a whole new session tomorrow, again looking at all the changes that have occurred from data records that have gone back from 20 years ago to the present. We're actually seeing organisms that are declining. And we're trying to figure out why they're declining. Some organisms are doing better, so we have to understand that. Even there was a talk today about how some parasites that affect organisms, how they will do better or worse in the future. So you have to look at all these different interactions between the organisms and how they will affect the environment and how that affect our food security.
So what suggestions do you have for the public or for our non-scientists out there that are interested in ocean acidification and want to learn more about it?
Well, we have some wonderful websites on ocean acidification. My group, if you go to Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, just key in PMEL and look under ocean acidification, we have a whole nice instructional tool about ocean acidification with lots of movies, lots of projections of how this will look like in the future. And you can look there. There's the National Program on Ocean Acidification that's hosted by NOAA. It's the NOAA Ocean Acidification Program. So it's a NOAA OA program. And you can look at put NOAA OA and you'll get it right up. A whole nother website. And we also have an international website, the International Ocean Acidification International Coordination Center. And they also have a tutorial on ocean acidification. So there's many, many materials. They're all very good, and they show exactly what's occurring throughout the oceans, as far as we know. And we're developing an international observing system that just got started this year. And you can go to any one of those locations and find the data yourself. And you can use that as a teaching tool for kids to see how this occurs. It's a wonderful tool to work with.
That's nice to hear that this is an international collaboration, too, because ocean acidification is not something that's just going to affect us here in the United States.
We had 100 scientists from 30 nations working together on this observing system. And this has just started in the last 2 years. It's a tremendous response.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. And did you have an international showing at your symposium today?
Oh, absolutely. We had scientists from China and Japan and Europe and even South America join us for the first time. This was a great international conference, and all the researchers are very, very excited about this research because it's all for the very first time that we're seeing this new information. It's really exciting.
That's fantastic. So aside from the ocean acidification session you have tomorrow, anything you're looking forward to besides that at the Ocean Sciences meeting?
Oh, my goodness. There's so many interesting things that we're talking about at this meeting. It's a very exciting meeting. We're talking about the global carbon cycle and climate change and how the oceans play such an incredible role in the global carbon cycle. That will be occurring on Thursday and Friday. We're talking about what it means for the oceans to take up that carbon dioxide in terms of how that affects global climate change and global warming. And we're also talking about marine ecosystems and how they will respond in a long time. So this is a very good week, and we're all excited to be here.
Well, I'm so happy you could be here today. Thank you so much. I want to take a moment here to thank all of our guests who could join us. For more information or to listen to our podcast, be sure to check out our website, www.cosi-ie.net. I would also like to give a special thank you to Jeff Davis, the solar guy, Kosi Island Earth, and the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Kosi Island Earth is a National Science Foundation-funded program. I'm Carly Weiner. Thanks for listening. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.